Genius is a word for guardian spirit. Your own innate guardian spirit sense helps you to really purify yourself. Once you know that that can be done, even in just a little bit, even a smidgen, your inner guardian spirit sense of, it might take a couple of weeks, it might take a couple of months, God forbid, it might take a couple of years, but finally you come to realize, I can get cleaned up, and then you do it. But the trigger in that whole process of purifying is realizing, hey, I've got to make a statement. I've got to, in the Indian sense, I've got to send my voice. The reason why the Great Spirit hasn't heard me is I haven't been able to send my voice. I've been muttering to myself, and I've been muttering to people in this world, but I haven't sent my voice to the Great Spirit. And the crying for a vision is the coming to one's presence so that one can speak from one's presence. And when the voice is powered by your presence, you can send it. It's like that lance of the sutra structure. Then you know where to put your grasp. Then you know where to put your comprehension. And then you can not throw a lance, but you can send your voice. And when you send your voice, let's get Black Elk's prayer.
He gives us a prayer here. They are sending a voice to me from the place where the sun goes down. Our grandfather is sending a voice to me from where the sun goes down. They are talking to me as they come. Our grandfather's voice is calling to me. That winged one there, where the giant lives, is sending a voice to me. He is calling to me. Our grandfather is calling to me. When one is able to send a voice, one is also able to hear a voice. There's like an existential correlate that when you know that you can speak from your presence can also hear. And what does it hear? It hears that the Great Spirit knows you individually, is talking to you. Not in any kind of general terms, but specifically, even more specifically, radically than existential. As an eerie experience when one first experiences that is very strange. And if you have any kind of humility at all, the realization that comes up, billowing like clouds, papancha they say in Sanskrit, the conception that comes up is, well then who am I? Who am I that God knows who I am? And you can wipe your brow with all the banners of achievement, because then you've learned something really important. You've learned that that presence which you've engendered through purification is able to not only call out, but to hear. Then there's a communication. That communication, in Martin Buber's immortal phrase, I and thou. Then the thou aspect is not just an other. God is not something else, but thou. I and thou is a beautiful way of expressing. In crying for a vision, the need for purification then is the inipi, the sweat lodge in Black Elk's level, his cultural style, but the experience in the sweat lodge where before it was an experience in a group of other human beings, this time it becomes very personal. This time whatever happens has a personal resonance. It didn't have a personal resonance before because one didn't know that you have a bell-like quality of presence in you whose pure tone can be sounded by these events. Now you ring. And the sound of you ringing is your silence, your inner silence. And in that inner silence, you realize that there's this presence of equanimity woven in the whole stream of life, that it never is not there. And then you become attentive to the fact, well, that's in me too, then. It's not in me, but it's in the light. There are some blank tapes in the drawer here. Notice the distractions are parenthetical. Notice the agility that if we want, we can work the parenthetical distractions into the discourse. We can braid them in. In really high dharma, one uses everything. Tibetan phrase for that is translated as called crazy wisdom. You use anything that happens. But that's sort of Toshiro Mifune type realization. Black elk crying for a vision. Hanblichyapi. Every man can cry for a vision or lament. And in the old days, we all, men and women, lamented all the time. What is received through the lamenting is determined in part by the character of the person who does this. For it is only those people who are very qualified to receive the great visions which are interpreted by our holy man and which give strength and health to our nation. Notice now that what's going to happen is that one is going to send a voice. Crying for a vision is actually sending a voice from your inner presence, which occurs in what you actually do. Not in what you think you do, or not in what you hope you're going to do, not in what somebody says that you're doing, but in what you actually are doing, your basic primordial ritual comportment, that your presence actually occurs there. Your quintessential center is actually there. And the ability for that quintessential center to amplify and include in color and tincture, the alchemist said, by the tone of the completeness of that ritual form, all of that also prepares you to receive a voice. And the voice that will come will tell you in a language form something which you will see and we call a vision, a great vision. And that great vision will change you. It's like Bobby becoming RFK. It's like Jesse learning that he doesn't have Dr. King to lean on anymore and had to find his own way. And finally did. Stopped showing up at Chicago City Hall begging political power groups to give some handouts and started to take part in the process by which this whole thing is engendered. And win, lose, or draw, that's the right thing to do. It's real. So the crying for vision now, ritual, like the purification rites of the sweat lodge, has been used long before the coming of our most sacred pipe. This way of praying is very important, indeed is at the center of our religion, for from it we have received many good things, even the four great rites which I shall soon describe. So that the purification and the sending of a voice and the having of your vision, like a vision quest, are all preparation. But while you're participating in them, there's no sense that this is preparation at all. This is the hardest thing that one has ever done. And it taxes you exactly, if you do it right, 100%. It takes from you exactly everything that you can give. Exactly everything. And woe for you who hold back the 1% just in case. Don't do it. Give it all. 100%. Fill up the psychophysical form right to the pate. Right to the ends of the hairs that will stand up. Because that's the only way to purify that psychophysical delusion that one has been living in. It's the only way. One has to give it all. One has to sacrifice oneself completely. Don't hold back. There's no rainy day more rainy than that day. So notice that the tone, the emotional tone of the language of the crying for a vision is lament, as in Jeremiah, lament. That's the tone. It's called plaintive in English rhetoric, plaintive. Into the sweat lodge, into the nepi, is purified a sacred pipe, and many other things which Black Elk talks about, which you can read for yourself. The other thing that's purified is a buffalo robe. A buffalo robe is the sense of one's initiation cloak. For instance, in the time of Jesus, it was just a white linen chemise. I guess we would call that clothing form today. The idea, the object, is that underneath this single cloak, one is naked. And that one knows that there is in no way any protection or shelter of one's nakedness to the actual experience except this cloak. And this cloak has been purified in a sense so that it is very close to transparent. The feeling tone of a purification is transparency. One doesn't become clean so much as clear. It's like that kind of a sense. Permeable. So if the cloak is permeable, the wind doesn't come through, but anything else is going to come through. And then this person, as Black Elk is giving us an example, it's a young man, takes the pipe, which is now his pipe, and that cloak, that buffalo robe, and he takes those in accompaniment of two companions and goes to a mountaintop. For a woman, Black Elk says, usually to a hilltop, which is closer into the village. He says, and not in a patronizing way, but women need protection and they can't just go out into a mountaintop by themselves. But the fact is that the ritual is that one goes to a place of eminence in the landscape so as to raise you up. And there, Black Elk shows how they make a quintessential cross, that in the first spot, whatever the spot on the mountaintop, of digging out like a little depression, the tobacco, which would have gone into the sacred pipe, goes into that depression, the kinnikinick. Kinnikinick is the phrase for that. It's a tobacco twisted so that it burns in a smoldering way that creates a lot of smoke. There's not much fire and there's a lot of smoke. So this twisted tobacco goes into that hole so that now the sacred pipe is ritually transfigured, I guess is the way, to the bowl is then in this in the ground on the mountaintop. And a pole is put there And that pole will be the center pole for the retreat structure. And then in the four directions from that, four other holes and four other poles are made. And then some nominal sort of covering. And the bed, the mat of the person is placed around the center pole so that the person then entering in to this retreat structure, this ritual structure, Black Elk says faces west initially, but faces it sitting so that one's back is to the center pole. Remember the Buddha sitting his back to the tree. So at this ritual structure of sending a voice, one has to put one's spine on the center pole of that ritual presence. Now you don't need to go into some kind of physiological ritual structure for that, but it's always helpful to know that you can do it this way. In actual fact, in many sophisticated presentations of this, you can do that wherever you are, wherever it is that you are. The spinal column of your neurophysical integration is the pole of a ritual comportment which has a quaternary amplification from that quintessential center. In Satipatthana, it's your actual posture which engenders the presence. So that as you move, the posture is kept ritually exact, erect, intact. If one is seated, usually you have to put something under your behind so that in your seated position, the spinal column is exactly straight. It has to be lifted up a little bit in the back so that there is a physiological stiffening up. And what happens is that all of the organs, which usually have been hanging, now are clearly appended around this center. And the physiological area around the Manipura chakra, as it is the it's like the solar plexus area. And that is tensed and stressed in a muscular, physiological way in a very, it's almost like perpendicular to the spine. It has an exact tension to it. So that any kind of physiological fidgeting records itself there accurately and instantly. And it's like a barometer that tells you you're moving around. You need to stay still. And then the other aspect of it is that you tend to your body, because when it is still like that, its normal experience in this world is to fall asleep. The body is used to thinking, oh, well, that's sleep. When you're that still, well, you should be asleep. When you sleep, you dream. And so when you're young or naive or inexperienced, you tend to dream, just as if you were asleep. And you need to awake from that. You need to not just dream. You're not sitting there to sleep. That's not what's going on at all. Why is the body doing this? Because it has never been in that particular mode other than sleep. And yet, that's that primordiality. Here's how Black Elk presents it. The lamenter now takes off his moccasins, barefooted. Remember what we said before the break. And even his breech cloth. If we really wish to lament, we must be poor in the things of this world. Well, it's not only just being poor in the things of this world. It's like getting into the ritual physiological contact necessary, naked to this world, is a primordial ritual comportment. For instance, all beings in a moment of existential interchange have a desire as it is to be naked. And it's not just a sexual thing, it's primordial. It's on a very, very deep realization that this is an interchange point, that one doesn't take any baggage, excess baggage with one on that interchange point. One is as one is. En naturel, beyond the point of nakedness to the point of a present, bringing everything that one is to that focus, to that point. It's a question of spiritual etiquette, necessary etiquette. He walks alone up to the top of the mountain, holding his pipe in front of him and carrying his buffalo robe, which he will use at night. As he walks, he cries continually, "O Great Spirit, be merciful to me, that my people may live." Entering the sacred place, the lamenter goes directly to the center pole, where he faces the west, and holding up his pipe with both hands, he continues to cry, "O Wakantanka, have pity, Wakantanka, on me, Wakantanka, that my people, Wakantanka, may live." Then walking very slowly, he goes to the pole at the west, where he offers up the same prayer, and then returns to the center. Then he progressively goes to each of the poles and coming back to the center, so that his actions are a weaving of the whole quaternary in terms of its cardinal splay with the center, so that the entire area is covered, but covered in a ritual way, not in a natural way. The natural way to cover an area is to cover every square inch. The ritual way is to select the quaternary in the center and weave it that way. Notice how ritual is a selection of nature. It selects out of nature. It has all the power, all the amperage of nature condensed. So that in ritual, beings learn to condense the natural power, which is very great already. And when it's condensed, a very peculiar kind of exponential value occurs. It's like when you first begin to condense it, it becomes geometric. It becomes exponential in a geometric scale. But after one has achieved a quality of presence, it becomes trigonometric. And the selective power of prayer becomes extraordinary, really filled with amplification. Then walking very slowly, he goes to the pole at the west, where he offers up the same prayer and then returns to the center. In the same manner, he goes to the poles at the north, the east, and the south, always returning to the center each time. After completing one of these rounds, he raises his pipe to the heavens, asking the wingeds and all things to help him. And then pointing the pipe stem to the earth, he asks aid from all that grows upon our mother. All this takes very little time to tell, yet the lamenter should do it all so slowly and in such a sacred manner that often he may take an hour or even two to make one of these rounds. That's that slow motion. But by adding consciousness to the ritual comportment, that slow motion is taken out of time. It's like there's a transformation. And that activity no longer takes place in the world, but it begins to take place, it like blinks into efficacy in the real universe. The universe as a whole, which has no fragmentation whatsoever. So that activity is purified out of the world into eternity. And it happens in such a way that one is never conscious of it happening, but one is conscious that something has shifted. It's like this. Something has changed. You're not sure what. But there's a poignant sense that it's different. It is different. And there's a recursive function to this kind of realization. I'm different. And the technique here is not to dwell on that at all. Not to dwell, well, what is different about me? You see, that's egotistical. That's carrying the goddamn habits of a lifetime of fooling around with you into the sacred activity. Forget it. What's important is to keep that process in a sacred manner. That is to keep the quality of presence there regardless of what one realizes or does not realize. That's why the efficacy is on the ritual level, on what you do. And what you do is the key to it all, you see. The lamenter can move in no other manner than this, which is in the form of a cross, although he may linger at any one place as long as he wishes, but all day long this is what he does, praying constantly, either out loud or silently to himself, for the Great Spirit is everywhere. He hears whatever is in our minds and hearts, and it is not necessary to speak to him in a loud voice. The sending of the voice is sent from one's presence and not from the vocal cords. And it slowly changes so that one is lamenting out loud, and then after some long while in this, experiencing the words in your center is like saying them. It's just as loud as saying them. It's like that. The lamenter need not always use this prayer that I have given, for he may remain silent with his whole attention directed to the Great Spirit or to one of his powers. He must always be careful lest distracting thoughts come to him. Oh, I'm different. Oh, why am I different? Say, distraction. Forget it. It's not important. Yet he must be alert to recognize any messenger which the Great Spirit may send to him. For these people often come in the form of an animal, even one as small and as seemingly insignificant as a little ant. That is, by guarding one's presence in this ritual comportment, what actually is real happens. So if one keeps disregarding one's own associative, habitual qualities, you can notice then when something enters into you. And because you've been sealing yourself in that sacred manner, and keeping your extraneousness out, even the slightest little variation coming in, you know, is not from you. That didn't come from you. And if you don't dwell on, oh, well, where did it come from, it'll continue to happen. And as it continues to happen, that the sensitivity to that amplifies. And that's like the seed of the vision then opens up. And one can experience that which you did not produce but occurs in this primordiality of your ritual comportment. You can see now that the ritual level is not a primitive level at all. It's the foundation, it's the basement of the real world. It's the basement of the real world. Black Elk says, it can even be something as small and insignificant as a little ant. That is, whatever is occurring now in actuality is a part of the reality of what's happening. Now, you may not hear a voice at all. You may not see anything at all. But something will be occurring, and whatever that is, that's what's happening. That is what is happening. Perhaps a spotted eagle may come to him from the west, or a black eagle from the north, or the bald eagle from the east, or even the red-headed woodpecker may come to him from the south. And even though none of these speak to him at first, they are important and should be observed. Notice that the the technique, the art of ritual comportment is to be able to be purified enough to see what is exactly happening. It's like the Satipatthana mindfulness of the Buddha, or being in the place of sending a voice. One actually observes what is in fact happening. And what is in fact happening is real. It's not only real in that observational thesis that one has, but is real in the universe. And it's like a yoga. The whole universe moves in just the way that this part that's there for you is moving. It can even just be an ant crawling around. That's the way that the universe actually is moving. And if one is able to observe that, read out in terms of the physical being that we are. And just so, the life that we live is read out from these strands, from these ritual comportment integrities, which are not endless, but have a beginning, they have a current, and they have an end. But in the current has a kind of a twisting, has kind of a spiralet kind of a form, so that these ritual threads are the seeds of the mythology. The mythologies are going to be the body which is projected out from these DNA threads of ritual comportment, so that the mythologies will have a structural pattern exactly like the ritual. Now, it's one thing to say from like an anthropological perspective or a psychological perspective that mythologies are founded on ritual. Well, yes, that's true. But one doesn't understand in the great resonant penetration of how true that is and what that means. Whereas you're in a position now, because of this Saturday morning situation, to at least appreciate that there is a very titanic mysteriousness happening here. Nature has a certain pattern. The ritual comportment of man is like a selective imitation of that pattern. And the mythological cycles are like a third wheel, all in that line. What unites them, what unites those three wheels, is an axle of presence. And by the time you get to the third wheel of being able to comprehend the mythological level, one understands that it's all held together by that interior presence of the axle coming through the hub of all those wheels. And that's when meaning interiorizes and comes to focus in the symbolic self. One's interior self, one's secret self, not one's ego, but the self that one really is there in a primordial way, has nothing to do with the limitations of this life, has nothing to do with that at all, is a real presence which has always been there because it occurred in the universe, in nature, before there was anything else. Finito. I ain't talking no more. I'm going home. Is that your machine?